Does anybody else need water? Yes, I'd like some.
Do you want more coffee? I'd like to welcome you to the fifth of the series in Women Searching for Self. I would like to just say before we start introducing the speakers tonight, if there are any spirits hovering around that you feel, it's because we had four very impressive speakers all day today speaking about how to become a politically effective woman. The fantastic, I don't know what it was, but they just gave us so much. It included Iantha Lavander and Joan Grow, Martha Head, Diane Arends, all women who have jumped in and they're in the middle of it. I think that's, if you do feel any vibrations, that is where it's from. And tonight I would like to introduce a moderator for our panel called, our topic tonight is Women and Social Reform, Yvette Oldenmeyer, Oldendorf. Excuse me, Oldendorf, who was formerly the director of Aesthetic Environment Program, is now working on a series of 6 half-hour television shows, which are taking over the women historians of the Midwest. One has been produced, which is called Double Vision, which is about women in education in Minnesota. Yvette is doing the script writing, producing, and directing of these. So as our moderator tonight, I'm sure she will have much to say.
I just this evening heard a very interesting little story, and it had to do with a great many of the shakeups that go on in the federal departments in Washington. And you know, the men come and go, and there are always changes, and we just had a vision of one of those changes a couple of days ago. And as you know, the women stay, the secretaries are there and there and there. And one of them was about to go out for lunch, and she went to the receptionist and said, I'm leaving now. If my boss calls, will you be sure to get his name? And that's in part how I feel tonight, too, because I am substituting for Dr. Gretchen Kreuter, who is usually your moderator at these meetings and who indeed is also participating in the production of the film series. And also, because we want to make sure we get the name, some of the members of the panel are not as listed in your program, so we want to be sure to introduce them to you properly. I'd like first to tell you who is here and then introduce them each individually before each of their topics. We have here Celia Hyland to speak on Sister Giovanni. We have Dr. Betty Green, who is going to speak on conflicts with the establishment, and Elizabeth Gilman, who will speak on the Women's Cooperative Alliance. So we have a very distinguished panel, and I think that we probably can do battle with any of the vibrations that were left from this afternoon and leave some of our own. Our first speaker tonight is Celia Hyland, and I was very pleased to meet her for the first time tonight, because I find that we have tread some of the same paths, have lived in the same neighborhood, have gone to some of the same schools, and have never met each other. And I was pleased to meet her tonight. She has worked for 5 years for the Guadalupe Area Project and is now one of its board members. She is now working with the Migrant Tutorial Program, which is a federal project with the St. Paul Public Schools. I am very pleased to have met her, and I think that when you meet her, you will be as pleased as I, Celia Hyland.
Hi, are you all awake? It's already getting late. I'm certainly no substitute for Sister Giovanni, because probably some of you already know her, and she's really a real dynamic person. But I'll try to fill in for her and her project. Guadalupe Area Project is down on the west side of St. Paul. It serves the Mexican-American community. It's really a multi-service center, and it's mostly going toward education. There are 6 fields of education. The dropout school, which is the teenagers, 14 to 19-year-olds, the adults that come at night. Career planning, these are mothers, young gals that would like to plan a career, and she has a key punch, typing, that type of thing, secretarial work. Remedial reading that goes on in the summertime, this is working with all the young kids in the area, as many as we can handle, and it's mornings, afternoon is the arts and crafts thing. We have GED, we offer this to the community also, and we've had over 200 of the people get their GED. We have a tutoring program now. I've met some of the teachers from the St. Paul schools here tonight, and it's really become a problem, or it has been, but lately more so, that we've gotten a lot of Spanish-speaking children new in the St. Paul schools, and it's apparent that anyone that has anything to do with education is doing tutoring, too, on the side. Right now, Guadalupe Harry Project is in financial trouble until January, when United Way is going to help us out. We've got a skeleton crew working down at the ceramic shop. We've got a skeleton crew teaching. We've got a skeleton crew hanging on to the house itself. Let's see. We do a lot of social services. We do counseling, a one-shot type of affair, and we refer them. We're a referral to every agency in town. We have a food program, and this is an emergency cupboard type of food program, and she has a saying in her house, real nice and large for everybody to see, why is there so much month at the end of the money? We have referrals to housing. We have girls' clubs that meet there. And she has also a saying, the door pushes in, honey. Come on in. And this is, she always offers herself, her house, to anyone that is in need and hurting. Like I say, it's mostly geared toward the Mexican-American community and Mexicans that are from out of the area. But she does accept hardship cases. Her support right now is mostly through donations, through retired people that always manage to send her five or two, whatever, in the mail, and she's keeping going this way. And by going out and speaking to communities, parishes, anywhere where she can, they'll let her come. She goes there and talks to them. What else can I tell you? Everything else that goes on in there. This year we don't have our phase two program, which was after school hours, a lot of young gals that were pregnant would come in and finish their schooling. For some reason or other, there are no pregnant gals on the west side this year, so we don't have that. That was a real fun time. It was really nice to see them all coming, and they were getting, plus their schooling, they were learning a lot of other things, you know, for themselves and for the children that they were going to have. This year also, the kids have asked for religion, which is something that she's always stayed away from, and they've asked for it, and she's going to give it to them. There are a lot of teenagers down there that haven't been so much as baptized, and so they've asked for this. This is something special that she's going to offer. I won't be staying afterwards for the question and answer period because I've got another meeting to attend. I have brought along some things that we sell out of the house, and I'm going to tell you like she tells all of the people that she speaks to. There's nothing out there that you need, but what we do need your donations. So if you just pick something up and help us out, if you would, please. Thank you.
Thank you. I think that the story of what Sister Giovanni is doing in the Guadalupe area is an interesting one, because while we have viewed nuns in Minnesota essentially as the teachers and nurses, she is an outstanding example of a woman participating very directly in social change, and She herself is the social change agent, which is exciting to know. Thank you for telling us more about what she's doing. Yes, we must tell them how to get there, too. The west side of St. Paul is very easy to get to now that the Lafayette is open. And if you will take the Lafayette exit off of 94, as you get to the first exit, which is Concord Street, you'll see GAP on a building right there. Just take the exit off there on Concord and visit it. And also the church is right across the street, so it's a very nice center. And I guess it's open just about all hours, isn't
it?
And particularly if you need help, it's open.
Right.
Our next speaker is Elizabeth Gilman, who is in the Manuscripts Department of the Minnesota Historical Society. She's one of those people who provides the help for a great deal of the research that is now going on in women's history. She will probably later be known as one of those unsung heroines of the women's history movement, because she knows where it's at, very literally. She has done her degree work in history at Grinnell, and she specializes in the progressive era. Her topic tonight is the Women's Cooperative Alliance, and I'd like you to welcome with me Elizabeth Gilman.
Thank you. The Women's Cooperative Alliance, incidentally, there's a misprint in the program. My topic is the Women's Cooperative Alliance, not the Women's National Alliance. The difference is significant because the Women's Cooperative Alliance, or the Women's Cooperative Committee, as it was originally called, never extended itself much beyond Minneapolis. In fact, it never reached St. Paul, although it had many grand schemes. It was far from isolated, however, from the mainstream of events in the country as a whole. Indeed, its primary historical importance is that it constitutes a perfect example of the moralistic, reformist social mindset and the type of feminism which predominated the nation during the Progressive Era. The origins of the Women's Cooperative Committee, although somewhat unclear, can be traced to 1914, when a sensational and publicized trial took place in Minneapolis. A wealthy and socially prominent manufacturer had been accused of sexually abusing young girls. The Cooperative Committee, or at least some of the women who were later to be most active in it, assisted in obtaining a conviction in his case. The indignation and reforming zeal inspired by this trial apparently moved the women to form a more permanent organization to combat and prevent social evil, particularly juvenile delinquency, in Minneapolis. A few groups with these purposes already existed. So in September 1915, seven organizations formed the Women's Cooperative Committee. These original organizations included the Women's Welfare League, the Women's Clubs, the Women's Christian Association, League of Catholic Women, Council of Jewish Women, and the Industrial and Social Conditions Committee of both the Fifth District State Federation of Women's Clubs and the State Federation of Women's Clubs. They cooperated to hire a female investigator to observe and report conditions in the city. With the help of a network of volunteers, she investigated saloons, dance halls, theaters, and moving picture houses, rooming houses that might harbor prostitutes, or establishments such as ice cream parlors, where young people might congregate and be exposed to dangerous people, men by implication, who could corrupt them. It was not until the executive secretary joined the staff in September of 1916, however, that the group became fully mobilized. The executive secretary was Catherine Cook Gilman. Mrs. Gilman, and I call her Mrs. Gilman only because I think she would have preferred to be called that way. Mrs. Gilman was a social feminist and a former teacher turned social worker. As the social work profession was even then in its formative stages, she had received her training in the same way that all pioneers of her profession did, through practical experience. Her first exposure to the profession came when she was a graduate student at the University of Chicago, and she spent some time at Hull House with Jane Addams. Mrs. Gilman must have been at the University of Chicago along with Sister Antonia McHugh, whom we heard about from Sister Karen Canelli earlier, 3 weeks ago in the series. Mrs. Gilman then moved to New York City, where she worked at the East Side House Settlement and the University Settlement. At the latter establishment, she met her future husband, Robbins Gilman. They were married late in 1914 and moved to Minneapolis in January of 1915 so that Robbins Gilman could take over his new post as head worker of the Northeast Neighborhood House. In the short time that she lived in Minneapolis, Mrs. Gilman had already gained recognition as a leader in the child welfare cause and the suffrage movement. I have called her a social feminist, a term which I borrow from William O'Neill's history of feminism, Everyone Was Brave. O'Neill defines a social feminist as one who is more interested in social reform than in economic revolution. Economic revolution would alter the nature of the nuclear family in capitalist society, thus freeing women to take their places as the equals of men. Social feminists, however, devoted their attention to strengthening the nuclear family. Mrs. Gilman, for instance, lectured that, quote, "The home is the essential controlling and humanizing factor in human evolution, and its spirit the only prophecy we have for a future society which has in it any trace of hope," unquote. Furthermore, social feminists like Mrs. Gilman did not seek social and economic equality with men because they did not believe themselves to be the equals of men. They believed themselves to be morally superior to men. This moral superiority they saw as the weapon with which they would attack male-corrupted government and society. The same attributes which uniquely qualified a woman for making a respectable home and bringing up morally sensitive children also qualified a woman for exerting a salutary and wholesome influence on society at large. As Mrs. Gilman wrote, quote, "The function of a mother in politics is identical with the function of a mother in the home. Her work is creative, productive, spiritual, and moral. She brings the impersonal selfless service of a mother to the otherwise selfish situation. She is devoted to an ideal, and that ideal is based on an inherent protective conservation of health, morals, and education for her children, her family, and her home." This concern with the moral superiority of women approaches the central issue of our lecture series here, that is, how have the laws, public policies, and expectations of individual women been different from those of men in society? And how have these laws, public policies, and expectations changed in Minnesota? Catherine Gilman and her fellows in the Women's Cooperative Alliance expected that women's moral superiority could materially change and reform society, an expectation which they were to discover few men shared or honored. I will not dwell now on the second part of the question, that is, how these expectations have changed, simply because that might easily constitute another lecture entirely. To state the case simply, few women associated with the feminist or humanist movements today would subscribe to Mrs. Gilman's views on women's moral nature and their implications for women's role in home and society. As a new executive secretary of the Women's Cooperative Alliance, Mrs. Gilman set to work with all the energy and determination which was characteristic of her. From January to July 1917, she addressed 24 church clubs, 25 study or social clubs, and 43 mothers' clubs of the Parents and Teachers Association. The investigator, who now worked full-time also, received and disposed of 247 reports of immorality. A big sister, whose duties included befriending and helping needy girls, was hired in December of 1916, and as of the following April, she had handled 137 cases. Four secretaries were hired to supervise the organizational work in the community, and these secretaries were responsible for visiting every home in their ward so as to reach those women who did not belong to groups and therefore would not have heard a representative of the Alliance speak. By the close of 1918, the paid staff had increased to 16, including 7 district secretaries, 2 investigators, and 2 assistants to the big sister. 17 organizations were paid cooperating members. The Alliance incorporated and continued to grow until by the end of 1920, there were 24 paid workers, a mailing list of 8,300, and 19 cooperating organizations. The publications of the Alliance had been translated into Polish, Swedish, Norwegian, and Yiddish for immigrants who could not read English, and ethnic secretaries worked with Scandinavian, Jewish, Polish, and colored women. The program of the Alliance consisted of 3 related but separate aspects: the prevention of future juvenile delinquency, the improvement of social conditions to combat existing delinquency, and assistance for victims of adverse social conditions. The structure of this organization reflected this triple approach. As early as 1917, 3 departments had developed, which were to be known as the Education and Publicity Department, the Research and Investigation Department, and the Big Sister Department. Mrs. Gilman, as executive secretary, supervised the progress of all 3 and also worked at the unending task of fundraising. The Education and Publicity Department spearheaded the drive to prevent future juvenile delinquency through a comprehensive program of preschool sex education. in some way never truly associated, explained in all the literature that the Alliance published on this subject, ignorant abuses of sex by children and malicious sexual abuses perpetrated on children were assumed to lie at the root of all juvenile delinquency. While social reforms might be constructive and necessary, social hygiene and moral instruction were, the Alliance women believed, the measures which would reduce juvenile delinquency the most in the long run. The entire thrust of this effort was directed not towards the children themselves, but towards their parents. The home cannot give what the home has not, Mrs. Gilman emphasized in speech after speech. So she set out to educate parents, particularly mothers, but also fathers, so that they could and would perform their duties in rearing their children. The district secretaries of the Education and Publicity Department interviewed mothers in their homes or spoke to women's meetings. They distributed the Alliance's pamphlets on sex education, which encouraged parents to deal with sex in an open, frank, and honest fashion. Mrs. Gilman, who authored most of the pamphlets, had herself felt the consequences of the ignorance which had developed out of the Victorian mystique about reproduction. For example, when she was a teenager, she once burst into tears when an uncle, whom she had not seen for years, kissed her on the cheek. So little did she know of love and sex that she imagined a kiss from a member of the opposite sex to symbolize some sort of matrimonial tie. Such naivete, she felt, could be positively harmful to children and was at best obsolete in an age of scientific thinking. The whole aspect of emotional involvement in feelings, however, never appeared in the pamphlets or the mothers' conferences conducted by the Alliance. The simple scientific vocabulary, which Mrs. Gilman recommended, did not include desire, climax, or orgasm. No one reading the pamphlets she wrote would ever imagine that sexual intercourse could be pleasurable, or indeed any different from an involuntary bodily process such as digestion. Mrs. Gilman dealt with sex as dispassionately as she might have dealt with the weather, and this is exactly how she thought it ought to be treated by parents. In 1925, the University of Minnesota received a grant from the Bureau of Social Hygiene in New York, which in turn received its support from the Rockefeller Foundation, to conduct a study of the social hygiene program of the Alliance. Mrs. Charles C., or Kate Kuhn Bovey, a faithful and wealthy contributor to the Alliance, gave a matching sum to the organization, enabling it to accelerate the sex education program for the next 6 years. During that time, researchers from the sociology department of the university observed the work in progress. In the first phase, the work of the Alliance up to that point, materials written and used, the lectures given, and the results achieved were evaluated. In the second phase, a trained worker in the field accompanied parental advisors to the homes, interviewed parents, and observed the methods then in use by the Alliance. The results of these two phases of the study were published in 1931. The third phase was to have been the establishment of a school for other would-be parental advisors from all over the country, but funding for this project failed. Because of the Joint Social Hygiene Research Project, the Education and Publicity Department concentrated almost exclusively on parental education from 1925 to 31. But up until that time, 1925, the work of the Education and Publicity Department included community organization also. The district secretaries, in their speeches to civic groups and visits to homes, also recruited volunteers for other phases of the Alliance's program. Eight community committees were formed to which interested women could devote time and energy. Only two of the groups, the Court Visitation Committee and the Better Movie Movement, ever met regularly or accomplished much, however. Volunteers on the Court Visitation Committee went to trials involving sex crimes and tried to lend respectability to the proceedings. Rape and other sex crime trials often attracted a number of morbidly curious spectators, and the unpleasantness of testifying or bringing charges under such conditions often discouraged girls and women from prosecuting those who had attacked them. This is not an unfamiliar problem even now. The Court Visitation Committee, by its very presence, theoretically provided moral support for the witnesses and victims and lifted the tone of the proceedings beyond that of a sensational theatrical. The Better Movie Movement began by focusing on the physical conditions of the movie theaters in Minneapolis, that is, lighting, fire precautions, and exits, and so on, but soon grew to concern itself with the obscene and suggestive movies of the 1920s, and to do them credit, the movies of the 1920s were fairly risque. The Alliance hoped to organize citizens' committees around each movie house and voice to the manager of the theater the opposition of local residents to objectionable movies. They wanted to persuade the movie theater owners to exhibit only wholesome, instructive films. However, they soon discovered that the amount of influence they could wield on the local level was limited, inasmuch as the movie industry was a national one and their enemies lived not in Minneapolis but in Hollywood. Mrs. Gilman was to become very active in the Better Movie movement nationally, roughly from 1925 to 1936, and many of her Minneapolis friends helped her. Their campaign for better movies was no longer carried out under the aegis of the Alliance, however. The home visitation project of the Education and Publicity Department tied in naturally with the other functions of other departments in the Alliance. In visiting with mothers, the district secretaries often heard of morally dangerous conditions in the neighborhoods or of young women in need of help. They would then inform the research and investigation or the Big Sister departments, which could take appropriate action. The program of the Big Sister department was the most consistent over the years. While the other two divisions of the Alliance might experiment with their directions and methods, those of the Big Sisters remained constant. Friendship, the underlying philosophy of the department, could never be disproved or outmoded. An early pamphlet of theirs read in part, "Do you know of a girl who needs a friend? Do you know of a girl who needs employment, or who's dissatisfied with the kind of employment in which she is now engaged? Do you know of a girl who needs courage and a renewal of her self-respect?" The Big Sister, Miss Hattendorf, is ready at all times to go to any girl or cooperate with anyone or any organization for the benefit of girls. Now, as Dr. Gretchen Kreuter pointed out earlier in one of the lectures in this series, there was a great number of girls who had come to the cities, particularly Minneapolis, in search of factory or domestic jobs. The Big Sisters ministered to their needs, which were seen to be housing, employment, wholesome recreation, and spiritual support, not necessarily in that order. No girl's experience is too sad or too unfortunate to disqualify her from receiving our help, they claimed. The Big Sisters dealt with unwed mothers as well as girls without any sexual experience, English-speaking as well as foreign, and black as well as white. In 1928, the Big Sister Department became independent of the Alliance and incorporated itself. The Big Sister movement had a nationwide organization and was in no way unique to the Alliance, so the department's eventual split from the rest of the organization was natural. The Research and Investigation Department processed reports of unlawful and or immoral conditions in the community. Trained investigators, in quotes, because heaven only knows where they received their training, either referred reports to appropriate agencies or, if no other agency was willing or equipped to handle them, investigated personally. In addition, the department undertook an ambitious program of surveys focusing on social conditions in the various neighborhoods of Minneapolis and the incidence of juvenile delinquency. The program eventually expanded to include political action to secure enforcement of the laws and passage of additional morality legislation. As the workers of the Alliance discovered, they could visit a dance hall where liquor was allegedly sold and verify the charges. This was during Prohibition, remember. And then they could inform the police that a violation of the law indeed existed. But they could not force the police to close down the hall. Similarly, they could observe so-called immoral dancing or gambling at a street carnival. But until the city council passed an ordinance regulating carnivals, neither they nor the police could do much about it. Through research, scientific findings, and a comprehensive educational program for both legislators and the community at large, the Alliance hoped to mold public opinion for passage of socially and morally beneficial laws. The Alliance, of course, defined beneficial. During the 1920s, the organization's efforts with the legislature and Minneapolis City Council resulted in the practical elimination of street carnivals and gambling in Minneapolis, some degree of regulation of child labor on the stage, paternal support for children of divorced or unmarried parents, amendment of the Indecent Assault Act to include sodomy, and the creation of a women's bureau in the Minneapolis Police Department under the leadership of a female lieutenant, although the bureau did not possess the powers which the Alliance had hoped. Progress on the legislative front became increasingly difficult, however. Both the campaigns for stricter law enforcement and for social welfare legislation eventually made the women of the Alliance bitter and mistrustful of the city and state fathers. At the beginning of their work, the women believed officials would be willing to enforce existing laws and to pass enlightened ones as soon as they were made to see which laws were enlightened and had popular support. As time passed, however, an uneasy suspicion began to haunt Mrs. Gilman and her fellow workers that understaffing and insufficient funding did not totally explain the police department's laxity in enforcing morality laws. As for elected officials, the annual reports of the Alliance in the latter half of the 1920s abound with stories of insensitivity, patronizing treatment, broken promises, and unresponsiveness to organized, respectable citizenry. The women of the Alliance did not consider the possibility that morality laws could be basically unenforceable. Such an idea would never occur to those who believe that human beings could be saved from their baser instincts by laws and law enforcement. Underlying all the Alliance's efforts to combat juvenile delinquency was the assumption that proper moral behavior was easily defined, that everyone accepted the same definition, and that it could be described by the state through law, and that it could be enforced. Few in the Alliance doubted what was good and what was bad, nor did they imagine that any offender in his or her right mind would question the difference. If the offender did, then he or she, but usually he, was psychopathic and should be committed to a hospital or prison. Perhaps the basic weakness of the organization then was not the way in which it approached the problem of eliminating bad and promoting good, but the assumption that the difference between the two could be so easily defined. The world at large began questioning this assumption. Catherine Gilman and her associates were powerless to enforce the absolutes that they believed in. Consequently, they found themselves not directing social change as they intended, but dragged along by it. The Alliance's moralistic social reform program was outdistanced not only by changes in the society around it, but also by changes in the social work profession itself. I won't go into that because in the interests of time. The Alliance needed successes to stay alive, and by the end of the 20s, successes were increasingly few and far between. The members were discouraged with the lack of progress on the legislative and law enforcement fronts. The Alliance's social hygiene program may not have lived up to expectations either. The University of Minnesota study showed that out of the 250 women interviewed in depth by the Alliance over the 6 years of the study, only a negligible percentage changed their attitudes towards sex. Their children received only 24.83% more information about sexual matters than did the children of a control group. Now, don't ask me how they arrived at that 24.83. The calculations are incredibly difficult. Nevertheless, the Alliance women could take some perverse comfort in the fact that they had made some enemies in the power structure of the community. When the organization first became active, many political and business leaders gave cooperation and encouragement. Moralistic social reform enjoyed widespread popularity during the progressive era among community leaders as well as among social workers. However, in the disillusionment that followed the war to end all wars, and in the business prosperity of the 20s, this support lessened. Property leased to houses of prostitution proved far too lucrative to the quote-unquote respectable businessman who owned it to allow him to support his wife's reforming activities. Obscene movies drew far greater crowds than did wholesome ones. Liquor sold illegally produced a far larger profit than did soft drinks sold lawfully. When businessmen and government officials began to realize that the Alliance's programs actually threatened their economic interests, they became hostile, patronizing, deceitful, or rude. This reversal on the part of those considered by the Alliance to be its strongest allies, the community leaders, eventually resulted in the financial failure of the organization. The group had always been dependent upon a small coterie of faithful and wealthy contributors, despite Mrs. Gilman's efforts to broaden the financial base. During the early years of the Depression, the flow of money to the Alliance tapered off. Some business and community leaders supported the Alliance to the end, but Mrs. Gilman never forgot nor forgave those who pressured her main backers into withdrawing their support. As long as she was executive secretary, she would not allow the organization to continue with an inadequate program. So in October of 1932, the corporation voted to dissolve. Activities were suspended on January 1, 1933. I hate to end on a negative note, partly because of the irrational feeling that the Alliance suffered enough at the hands of its critics while it was alive, and it shouldn't have to suffer some more from its historian. It was, after all, a group of women who were organized and who demanded a share in the ruling of their community. Ironically, however, I believe that their attitudes towards themselves as women were one of the forces that undercut them. The Alliance contributed to its own undoing by its insistence that the sexes were different and that women's greatest strength lay in their moral superiority. The popular belief in sexual differences, which they accepted, allowed the male power structure to dismiss the Alliance as just women. More importantly, the Alliance's perceptions of sexual differences prevented it from challenging the male-dominated political economic structure on that structure's own grounds. Catherine Gilman and her co-workers restricted themselves to the use of moral suasion, which they considered the strongest weapon of a morally superior womankind. They did not seriously attempt to gain real political or economic power. Given the temper of the times, of course, such an attempt may have been even more short-lived than the alliance. Nevertheless, had the group analyzed the nature of the existing power structure and the roles of women in society more thoroughly, I believe that they might have developed approaches with greater long-range value.
Thank you very much for that, I think, rather insightful discussion. We were just having a discussion up here about moving the blackboard. We really weren't having an instant replay criticism of the last speech, but that was most interesting. Our next speaker, Dr. Betty Green, is the chairman of the Department of Sociology and Anthropology of Hamline University. Her degrees were obtained at the University of Minnesota in criminology and medical sociology. She is also serving now as the chair of the Ramsey Community Corrections Advisory Board, which is a mouthful, but here is an individual who not only has the background and capacity to discuss with us elements of social change in which women have participated, but she is one of the contemporary women who is herself participating in them. And so I would like you to welcome with me Dr. Betty Green to speak on conflicts with the establishment.
Seems like you're so far away. I don't like to talk to people that are so physically separated in the public address system. It always adds to that feeling, but maybe we can overcome it somehow. As I understood it, I was to try to give a kind of an overview to the topic for tonight of women and social reform, and especially about these conflicts with the establishment. I tried very hard to make this a talk about women and social reform, with the emphasis on women. And I actually had it outlined with sex as the big variable. And I divided it up like the enemy men, and then other women, and then ourselves as women. But the trouble is that as a sociologist, and I did feel that I was asked here basically as a sociologist and not in my role as a woman, I couldn't do it that way. I had to turn it around and talk about women and social reform. So I'm going to get back to Ty, unless I run out of my time, because I didn't understand there's a time limit. I'm certainly going to get back to the women part, but I am going to talk first about social reform in general. One time when I had been teaching for a few years, I had one of these evaluations that students give at the end of the course that I will never forget. It said, this was a pretty good course. This was a very good course. It was kind of a glowing thing, except once in a while when it got sociological. Now that's a double whammy, because it says, first of all, that it wasn't sociological very often, and that when it was, that was bad news. And that's hard on your sense of self if you're a sociologist. Okay, but we're going to go in for a little sociology here. And my apologies to those of you who have had a lot of sociology, because this is very elementary sociology, but I honestly feel that I can't talk about this topic without starting there. That's kind of the beginning for me. The very word reform, of course, implies change, and I think the way we use it, the connotation is that it will be changed for the better. So we start with that kind of a premise. But it's one of the ironies of life, and it's certainly one of the basic facts of sociology, that even when we plan things, we don't always get the result we plan for. And then even if we get that result, we may get a lot of others that we didn't plan for. Some sociologists call those unanticipated consequences. That makes it sound like they're explained somehow. But what that really means is that we didn't understand well enough what we were doing in the first place. It's not as if the things that we plan for follow rational principles, and then there are some others that happen sort of randomly. I think that the unanticipated consequences come just as logically from the things we do as the others. It's just that we frequently will take a problem out of context, some aspect of society that we say is a problem and ought to be changed, and plunge in to tackle it without looking enough at the general system and the other components about it. And that's one of the things I think we have to learn. We all know about things that have gone wrong. So that's one thing we know about reform. What else? My students also say, I learn most of what I know from my students, and you'll figure that out as I go along. They also frequently say, especially the ones that are concerned with social reform, I don't want to spend time learning theories. I just want to help people. Or they'll say, I just want to learn the practical things. And then, of course, I say to them, but how do you know what's practical? How do you know how to help people? And they think that is absolutely ridiculous, and they say, well, I know. But we all know that a lot of help has gone wrong and that a lot of things have turned out somehow the other kind of way. It's not only students that feel this way. I find a lot of this attitude in social agencies, a lot of anti-theory, and I do a lot of work with students doing part of their learning in social agencies, and I know that they often come back and say that the people in the agency say, well, she just learns it out of a book. How would she know that? That's not how it really is. And there is this kind of anti-theoretical bias. I think I understand that. It's because so much of social theory that we've had has been bad theory. By bad, I mean, you know, not accurate, not valid. And, of course, bad theory is of no use to anyone. But good theory that is based on good, sound, empirical evidence that's carefully gathered and then put together in a logical way into generalizations that will cover more than one situation is the most economical way to proceed, because once you have it, you can plug it into a lot of other things, and it helps you to cut out some of those unanticipated consequences if you work at it long enough. So let's look at what we know about change. I'll quit apologizing now for being theoretical, and maybe then we'll get to the specifics sooner. First of all, and this is why I kind of wanted the blackboard, but it isn't essential. You're all used to listening. I see you sitting there so obediently, and it's way over there, and we're recording. So you can imagine my ones and my diagrams, and I'll draw them in the air maybe. Not much of a drawer anyway. First, I want to distinguish something that maybe you all know, but I want to be sure we're all agreed about it, how we use it. I want to distinguish between cultural change and social change. Now, by culture, I refer to the beliefs, ideas, values, whatever, that we hold about ourselves and the world around us, and how to do things and all this sort of thing. And this, of course, is learned. It's not inherited, and it doesn't fall out of the air. It's taught to us by people. Sociologists believe that culture is learned throughout life. We don't quite go along with the Freudian notion that it's all accomplished by the age of five or whatever. But I think we all have to agree that very much of it is learned in the early years, and therefore, from that time on, it's very difficult to change people's views about these beliefs and values that they have been taught and have internalized very early. By the way, everyone, of course, has culture, as we use the term. Just last week, I was in someone's home where the man and the wife have an argument going about this, and she said, you talk to him about culture. And he said, we don't have culture in this country. They have it in Europe, but we don't have it. And I said to him, I'll bet you don't have an accent either. It's that same kind of thing. It's like accent that other people have and we don't. And it's that very lack of awareness about culture that makes it so resistant to change. You see, it's the fact that it is so taken for granted that what we have is, of course, the way. We have a term for this. We call it ethnocentrism. And if I ask a student on any test what is ethnocentrism, if they've been around me very long, they'll say something like, it's believing that your way of doing things is the best way. And if they're good students, they might say, believing that it's the only way or the natural way, because that's how it is even kind of more insidious, is that we think somehow that is the built-in natural way. And you ought to look at your own thinking and watch that natural way. Because if something is natural, that is from nature, it should be pretty universalistic. But there are very few universals in our social arrangements, as it turns out. And it turns out that what is my natural or best or only way of doing something is not necessarily someone else's. Now, I think in this day and age, with the kind of communications that we have, this notion of cultural relativity, which is what I'm talking about, is much better understood than it once was. And of course, travel makes it very easy. If you travel at all away from your home, you very quickly find that there are other
perfectly plausible ways of doing things that you had never questioned. But it's not automatic. I remember, I think it's about a year ago, that a man in Minnesota came back after 4 years of walking around the world and said, "The world is full of dumb foreigners." And my students loved that. They brought that up to me as an example of ethnocentrism because they said he never understood that he was the foreigner all that time. And but he's happy. He said America's the best after all, and that was his conclusion after all that. Let's also remember that in a complex, heterogeneous society, we're not all taught to believe the same values and ideas and beliefs even within one society. Certainly, there is a broad underlying kind of socialization that goes on in a mass society, aided very much by things like mass media, our universal compulsory education, and so forth. There certainly is a broad underlying kind of similarity, but there are also some very important differences due to ethnicity, due to sex, due to region, and so forth, social class, that do make a lot of difference. So we have to remember that it's not just when you go to other countries that you see these differences. At any rate, we know whatever the culture contains, that cultural change occurs very slowly and with a good deal of difficulty and discomfort on the part of the people who have to change it. It is not an easy kind of process. Now let me talk about social change for just a minute, the other kind that I wanted to distinguish. By that, I refer to a more here and now, immediate kind of phenomenon, a change in the actual social arrangements or the social patterns of our lives, the way we do things. Now obviously they're very highly related. The things we believe and the things we do certainly bear a close relationship. I'm just separating them for the purpose of analysis because it is kind of useful sometimes. You might think that cultural change would precede social change. You know, you change your ideas and then you start acting differently. Actually, that's not the way it happens. And racial inequality in this country was kind of nurtured on that sort of fond hope. We will change people's ideas. We will teach everyone that it's not nice to have prejudice about races. And then when they've all finally learned that, they'll all stop discriminating. It didn't seem that there was very much progress made along that line. I think that cultural change actually will always proceed more slowly for the reasons I mentioned. It is kind of out of your awareness. It is ingrained into you, and it's very, very hard to change that. Whereas social change can happen more quickly. Now remember, I did say that they really usually happen together, and usually you have an interchange. Something is happening in the social arena that's making your beliefs change and vice versa. And they're not as split as I'm doing for heuristic purposes here. But we could find examples of social change that would happen quite quickly. Natural phenomena such as floods, tornadoes, fires can make changes very quickly in a community, which will call for other social arrangements then. You must quickly, and you don't take time to say, do I believe in this? You simply do what seems to be done, must be done. Other not so natural but widespread phenomena such as wars are another example. And if you look at World War II, which I think of as my war, that I understand the best, we had fairly quick changes in the needs for the kinds of goods produced and the distribution of them. And this got quite quickly into needs for manpower and woman power. Men went off to war. Women went into munitions factories. A lot of women went outside the home who never would have worked outside the home otherwise. The dating and mating patterns changed. What was proper in many cases got stretched, altered. And a lot of those changes have never gone back, by the way. They've remained, maybe altered somewhat, but a lot of those changes stayed with us. Or we could have a change through the passage of laws. Now this, in a sense, is a little bit slower because you certainly have to build up to some kind of a legislative change. And yet, in another sense, there is one day when an 18-year-old cannot vote and another day when she or he can. And likewise for the 18-year-old drink. I thought of these examples because I think we're right now very aware of all the changes that produced in social arrangements. or some of the things that have happened in both in legislation and in Supreme Court decisions on abortion, for instance, what a difference that has made in women's lives. Or finally, a corporate decision, which can happen quite quickly. The decision, if Minnegasco decides to go to northern Minnesota and start taking peat, we're now hearing things on the radio about what that's going to call for in the way of arrangements and housing and all of the other related things that are going to happen to those communities. Now, you may notice that I brought my examples along a line of progression in terms of how much planning or intent there was. We don't assume that natural phenomena are planned at all. Wars are planned, but not for the purposes that I mentioned, not for those social and cultural changes. In fact, I think if the men who made the decisions to go into World War II had realized the change in women's roles that would follow, I feel they might have figured out some other way to do it they had in mind. I don't know, but I think that might be so. President Nixon was more aware of that when he got a bill for daycare, and he quickly said, this will destroy the family system as we know it. So they're getting to be a little bit smarter about that. But legislated changes are conscious ones, and so are corporate ones. You know, someone decides it, plans it, and does it. And you'll also notice something else about those planned decisions. Am I speaking too closely to this? Can you understand? You'll also notice something else about this, and that is that they require a certain kind of power. If you're going to plan it and carry it out, there has to be a certain kind of power involved. Now, we really wish we had time to talk about power, because there's a lot known about that, too. We don't. So I won't, but I'm going to say a couple of things. Max Weber, one of the early sociologists, German sociologists, who's written a lot of things that are just as relevant today as they were in the 1800s, distinguished between two kinds of power. The kind of power that is legitimated, which he called authority, and the kind of power that exists just by force or whatever, control. And you can, we won't elaborate very much on that, but an example of the sheer force would be, say, a dictatorship, a military junta that takes over and has a certain kind of power by the force it can mobilize. You'll also think, most kinds you can think of that kind of power have to eventually be legitimated if they're going to hold on. And you'll find the cultural aspects coming along. Hitler, for instance, was carrying on the cultural change through his propaganda about the super race at the same time that he was very ruthlessly acting to exterminate the Jews. And more recently, we've seen the cultural revolution in China, which was to change the people's beliefs about how things ought to be after the power base was clearly established. But there is that kind of sense of power, and he spent most of his time talking about authority, the legitimated power. Now, let's tie this back into social reform. Here, with social reform, we're clearly talking about change that's engineered. And so we immediately have to look for the sources of power. Another side point about power is, as I see it, and here if I had the blackboard near me, I would just draw a circle for you to indicate that I think it's a kind of a closed amount, a finite thing. Now, not everyone agrees with me. Some people think that power is an expandable commodity or force. But the only way I know to operationalize power is to say that it is control over decisions. It's a way to get things decided the way you want them decided, and I don't think that's expandable. You can divide it and disseminate the power, you see. You can cut that pie into many other ways or any kinds of ways. But it seems to me there's a kind of a limited amount of it. Otherwise, you're having sort of pseudo-power or you're diluting somehow the quality of those decisions. And that is what is very interesting about it. When we used to first hear a lot of talk about black power, I would find that most students felt that it was a reasonable thing for black people to want power. However, if that had to come out of white power, that was another problem. They wanted to create some power to give to blacks. And I think a lot of men over the coffee cup or the cocktail or whatever will say, well, I really do agree with you that women ought to have more share in decision making. But not that men should have less, okay? So where are we going to get it, you see? That's always the problem, and to me it's that kind of unstretchable aspect of power that makes it very tricky to work with. So any time that a social reform calls for changes in the power structure, there is certainly going to be resistance because someone's going to have to give up if someone else is going to have to go and get it. Okay? And it doesn't, I don't need to point out to you, I'm sure, that those who stand well in the power structure will support this, you know, in the status quo, will not want any change. That is obvious. What is less obvious is that sometimes the people who are the complete have-nots in the power structure will also oppose the change. And that is harder to understand. I think that has to do with informal power that I'm not going to say much about except when we get back into women. That's where we've had some power. If you have learned to cope with what you have, and you've figured out your little ways of carving out whatever you can get from it, you may actually prefer that to some unknown situation where you're not sure how you're going to deal with it. And people who are kind of miserable or powerless always think things could be even worse. Reformers don't like to think that way, but lots of times the people who are in the direct line and are affected will feel that way, and they will resist the change too. Now, given this kind of, what my colleague would call a quick and dirty short course on social change, the wonder is that any of it ever occurs, you know. And some sociologists, by the way, just don't feel that it's very possible. It's just not in their thinking because they look along these lines I've just outlined to you. My whole area of sociology takes me into another aspect, into deviance and some other areas that explain change, but I certainly won't take you into that. But you can see the very great difficulty. Now let me try to fit the theme of women into the picture that I have already sketched of social reform and a social change. First of all, we know that women have not had much power in a formal sense. That is well documented. Some informal power, as I indicated, because we are so intimately involved with men who have the power. That is the source of it, and we are pretty close. You see, most men have some women pretty close to them. In fact, some women who oppose changes, I think, in women's role may do so because they understand so very well how to use that informal power. And they clearly much better off there than if they have to get out into the open competition for the other visible kind of power. And that's probably right for them. You know, that's probably true. But, all right, so without this kind of formal power we're talking about to affect decisions, if women want some kind of social reform then, which we now have said means change, which we said means power, where are they going to get it? Now, Weber went on, besides distinguishing between the kinds of power, he gave three kinds of sources or types of legitimation that authority can have, the legitimated kind of power. And I'll go very quickly down through them because I think it tells us something about what women must do if they want more power. The first kind is called traditional, and the source comes from tradition, and you all understand tradition. I don't have to explain that to you. It's out of the past. A person who has that kind of power, a father in a family or whatever, has it because it's always been that way. Once again, we said that women traditionally do not have much formal power, and you can't make tradition overnight. The nature of it is that it has to have been around, so you can't look for creating much of that kind, okay? The second kind he talked about is charismatic. That is, deriving from the unique personal characteristics of the individual. Now, I think that there have been some women who have had that kind of power, that kind of authority, and we could probably sketch them out. I'm sure Jane Addams had that kind of a following in addition to other kinds of authority. I think Margaret Sanger had it. Some women have done this, have been able to do some things on the basis of charismatic power. There are a couple of things we have to say about charismatic power. One, it has severe limitations as a source of power for anyone, male or female, because you literally can't take it with you. When the person is gone, and sometimes even before the person is gone, that source is gone. Some people's charisma does not last as long as they live, even. I mean, that it just fades away. But usually when you die, the power goes with you. It's not like traditional or the other kind I'm going to get to. There's some kind of interesting things about that, because I think of Kennedy, although he was an elected president and had certainly some tradition and some, you know, legal aspects. I think President Kennedy certainly had a lot of charisma for people, and it is fascinating to notice that his brothers do seem to have some of that same charisma, and I think that does have to do with the fact that they look somewhat alike, they talk somewhat alike, and maybe in some cases you can pass a bit of charisma on, or it does rub on to other people, but usually we think of people like Mahatma Gandhi or Jesus Christ or someone like this, and to the extent that their power lives on, someone moves in and organizes it in a different way, you see, and it's very unusual for it to continue. The other thing is that by the nature of our socialization, women are far less likely to have these pace-setting, charismatic leadership roles. We think of those as being male, and you can look in the arts and a lot of places to see that happen. Early in my teaching career, I was teaching in a rather large class at the university, and one of my friends came along and sat in. And she said to the student next to her, who didn't know that she knew me at all, "What do you think of her?" And this person said, "She's not bad for a woman." And those of us who teach, at least in that kind of college teaching, I think we understand that we have to teach in a different way. And I don't think it's any less effective a way, but we are not going to be the spellbinding. There aren't any real female Bob Newharts that I can think of, that kind of thing. You have to use yourself in a different way. That's really not. We've been socialized to look to certain kinds of people in those charismatic roles. So I think we're rather limited, but I do think that is an avenue that women have sometimes used. The third kind of source or kind of power or legitimation that Weber talked about was, it's been called legal, rational, legislative. The idea, what it means is that you get your authority by establishing rules or rights which are deliberately drawn up. They are explicit, formal. Now, that there's much more of that kind of authority in general around today than there was, and Weber saw the change coming in this, and he wrote a great deal about that. Now, here in theory, sex would be irrelevant. So would race, so would religion, because supposedly there are explicit bases for the authority, and anyone who fits into them would have the same kind of power. Now, I say in theory, because we know that even in our legislative processes, there's a great deal of the traditional and the charismatic that kind of hangs in there. And so those things, that's what we're talking about when we talk about equal rights, is the fact that those things have not always been honored. Nevertheless, since their authority does rest on this supposedly rational basis, it does mean that we at least know what to do when the rationality breaks down. We have some kind of recourse to processes that are laid out explicitly. And I see this as clearly the main way that women, or any other group for that matter, can effect social reforms. That's why something like the Equal Rights Amendment is so important to women, because they've got to have that kind of basis that they can go back to. Even though passing a law doesn't mean, we know this, it doesn't mean that everything will automatically fall into place. It is the kind of basis from which we can go back and appeal. Okay, now let me finish by going back to one of my earlier distinctions when I said that cultural and social change are interrelated, and especially in practice. I also said that engineered change is, if it's to be lasting at all, to go very long, it must have some accompanying cultural changes with it. The beliefs have to somewhat change, or you're not going to get the long-term change in patterns. If people don't adapt their beliefs and values to what they're doing or what they see being done around them, there's a lot of discord and we have great disruption, and that usually doesn't last for very long. You either change the beliefs or you change the rules, like prohibition, for instance. Well, in the process of learning the culture, which of course we call socialization, one of the ways in which it's achieved is by learning all kinds of roles. We teach people that role is expected behavior, right, for a certain position, and we teach them what we expect in this and that way. Just so happens that women have traditionally had very important roles in that transmission of culture. Women have had as mothers, and even when a mother is not there with a child, the surrogate is most likely to be a woman. Not always, of course, but most likely in those very important years. And also in recent times and in our society, the next most salient place is, of course, in the school. And although not all teachers are women, there's certainly a preponderance of women in the elementary years. And so women have, in the cultural aspect, been placed in very strategic and important positions for this kind of work. By the way, as a side note, you all know, I'm sure, that there's a very rapidly growing literature on the materials of socialization and the sexist nature of those. And people who are working for liberation of all kinds are attacking right there in the picture books and the story books and all these materials. That's where they're going after the stereotypes. And I think that that's a very rational kind of thing to do if that's what you want. At any rate, when enough women become convinced about any social reform, they have these direct avenues into the transmissions of culture. And this has been known and utilized a lot in a lot of places. Religious institutions have made use of this function, a lot of other people. I'm not saying something new, but I'm just pointing it out in connection with what we're talking about. But remember that I said cultural change seldom comes first. And I think women could teach children that it's not nice to discriminate against women, for instance, to stay with that example, until they're blue in the face. And it's not going to make a lot of difference in equal rights until they get some legislation like equal pay, equal work for equal pay for equal work, and so forth. That's just one of the facts that I think is there. Now, have I run over the time? I have about another few minutes, and I don't care whether you record it or not. If it's all right, I'll just say it. It's not really for posterity, it's just for you and me. Because there was a final closure I wanted to make, and that is because your pamphlet on the outside says, Women Searching for Self. And so I want to make some comments about that to wind up with after what I've said about change and social reform and where I think women fit into it. Because we get our sense of self or identity from these roles that we have, certainly not every little role, but the ones that seem most central, most salient to us, we kind of think of in a package. And we think, this is who I am. There's a test you can give people that says, who am I? And you ask them to list 20 questions. And some of you may have read research that's been done on this. And certainly the first half, at least, will all come out in roles, in important roles that will relate to that, that people will write down. I think for many women, the identity of social reformer in the cultural arena that I've just described, you know, that kind of soft, warm, nurturing, teaching children what things are nice and humane, has made a much better fit with the rest of the package that is traditionally available to women, that is wife and mother, and if you have a career, teacher and nurse. I think those things have gone along very well, this idea of the social reformer on the idea level. Much more so than would the aggressive, strong fighter for social reform. You see, it's been a minority of women who wanted the identity that go with the Carrie Nation kind of image. People might like what she did, but most women don't like to, I think of themselves in that particular kind of way because this is all part of the socialization. Now, if this is true, and it's only speculation on my part, then it has a couple of implications for women and social reform. I guess you might say there's good news and there's bad news. It suggests that women are ideologically inclined toward social reforms kinds of issues and are strategically in a good place to carry them out at this idea level. And to just take this highly relevant example of changing women's roles themselves, women have given, there's been some studies lately, women have given more thought to it, they're more conscious of it, they're more concerned about whether it is changing or not. Men don't think much about roles, and women are affecting changes in roles, no doubt about it, in women's and men's roles. But the other side of that coin, the irony of the unintended consequence, if you will, may be that if women are entirely successful in effecting this desired reform of equality, that they'll also be relinquishing some of that edge or advantage that they had on the image side. At the same time that women move out into the arenas of action, where I think they'll be more effective in the structural changes they want to make, and I've tried to make that very clear, that they will also, as they confront the power issues and as they compete with men about this and don't just stay back with the other women and children, that they will be seen and will see themselves in very different ways than before. I once argued with someone a couple of years ago that you could certainly be both strong and feminine, that there was nothing incompatible about that, and they took me to the dictionary, and I was just astonished to find that feminine means weak, and strong and aggressive means masculine. You see, there's somebody who's had control over the definitions. But they couldn't force those off on us if we didn't pretty much accept them. You know, it's a kind of an interesting thought. My real point here, though, is that part of the trade-off for not having equal opportunity, for not having formal power, is that we could allow ourselves to, we could see ourselves and have others see us as somehow more humane, more soft, more loving, you know, and so forth. And this nurturing role is pretty salient to most women. I would never say to all, but I think to the majority of women that I know, it's a highly salient thing. And I see an awful lot of women in this transitional time trying very hard to hold on to both sides, to move into that arena and to still hold on to that kind of nurturing role. And what it means is you need a 28-hour day to do all the things that it requires. And so I think that there's going to be some rethinking. So it's interesting. We have this topic about women and searching for self. Maybe in another generation, that would be considered a really archaic topic to even talk about, because maybe the way that people think about themselves will be so different. And I don't mean to say that I'm leaving with the idea of saying that those things are incompatible and cannot be worked out. What I'm saying is that I think we're seeing women experience discomfort at having to give up the part of the security and the kind of niceness of one aspect. And the reason we talk about concern about self is that we're having to rework that, rethink it. Maybe not even so much women who have already made their choices that they are going to be or that they are in the power struggle, but maybe a lot of women who hold back for that very reason, that they're not sure how they're going to see themselves. And we always have models that we can look at, models and anti-models, people that we admire and people that we definitely don't admire and don't want to look like, that affect our thoughts about that. Well, the last is very speculative, but I really, for my own sense of closure, I wanted to add it on to the other things that I said. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Some of your remarks reminded me, particularly as you're talking about changing roles, of one of the Saturday Review cartoons that I have always treasured, but it is untitled, and I think maybe I can put a title, something about changing roles on it. There is an immense ocean, and way out there in the distance in the ocean is a sinking ship. It's going down. And in the foreground, there is a lifeboat with men in it, and they all different kinds of men. Some of them look like sailors, and some look like just ordinary men. And a man in a captain's garb is standing up in the front of the lifeboat. And he's going, he looks like he's in terrible pain. And the caption then reads, "Oh my God, I forgot to shout women and children first." And perhaps indeed he had been acculturated in many new ways that we hadn't really intended when we started out on this. One thing we do intend, though, is for you to have a little bit of coffee time, for our panelists to have a bit of coffee, and then for us to return to exchange some questions and some ideas. So if we could break for coffee for about 10 minutes, let us reconvene in the same places for some talk, okay?